If any of you have any questions or comments or reports about the meditation, how it's going, we could start that way tonight.
I had to have minor surgery last week with a local anesthetic. And I have to keep myself occupied while it's going on, and I found focusing on the breathing very helpful.
Thank you. I've had a lot of reports from people who got in for surgery, sometimes major surgery, and sometimes the period of time waiting before they have to be pulled in. Often people feel kind of helpless. There's nothing they can do. They just lay there. They're laying there in this hospital bed and being rolled around. But when they start, they learn something like a meditation practice, and they do something like that, like following your breath, suddenly they feel like they have something they can do, and they feel don't feel so helpless anymore. And makes a huge difference. I've heard people doing it in the MRI machines. You go in these big tubes.
I noticed that my focus and concentration in all other aspects of my life has improved, especially at work.
Has improved?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I find that I'm much better able to focus at work and stay focused on my job instead of being distracted by everything else that's going on in the office.
Fantastic. So you feel like you're meditating every day and the benefits are spilling over into daily life? Or?
I think so. Yeah, I'm able to concentrate better.
Yeah. It's a pretty common thing that people report. And one of the interesting things to do is to have a daily meditation practice for maybe, say, 5 or 6 months. And then stop practicing for a couple of weeks or a week. And then see the difference. Because some people, the benefits of meditation are obvious right away, like you're talking about here. And for some people, the benefits are not so obvious. They seem to creep up on us. They kind of change. We get calmer, more mindful, more present, more centered. In a much slower, gradual way, and you kind of don't notice even the change. But then, after six, you think, well, what's the point of all this? I haven't seen any change. Then after 6 months, you stop sitting, and after 2 or 3 days or a week, you feel the difference. And you, wow, I didn't realize what a big impact that it made on my life. So I often recommend that if you're meditating for 6 months or something, to take a week off and see if that teaches you something about the benefits.
a lot more, and I'm weak more. So it's fairly significant in the 2 weeks that I've been doing this, the intensity of my feelings have kind of increased.
Well, that could make some sense, but how do you understand that?
Pardon?
How do you understand that's why that's happening?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Maybe I'm just aware of it, mm-hmm. Or there are some emotions that I've lived in thought that I don't actually manifest in feeling, that I actually feel them more.
Uh-huh. So sometimes the mindfulness is like a magnifying glass, and sometimes our inner life doesn't change in intensity, but the magnification does, and it can seem much bigger because of that. And sometimes emotions can be stronger because we're feeling them more directly. We're not feeling them through our thoughts and our distractions. And sometimes you can feel it more intensely because there's less between you and the emotion. Sometimes there's less resistance to it or less control over it, and just kind of moves through us in a freer way. And some people report that it gets more intense, but sometimes even though it gets more intense, people sometimes say that its duration is shorter. So I don't know, have you noticed that about yourself, the duration is shorter? Or?
Well, it's some levels.
So it's more intense, but it's also shorter. And some people report that like the first time I heard this is when someone had lost three. Maybe, I hope I didn't say this already, but sometimes I talk about it in intro class. A woman, a friend of mine, who lost a number of dear people to her, had died 1 year: her brother, her father, her best friend, and she had a lot of grief. And then she went on a 10-day meditation retreat, and she talked about the difference between grieving on the retreat and grieving at home. And the difference was that the grief was actually more intense on the retreat, but it only lasted for a couple of minutes. Whereas at home, the grief would be less intense, but it lasts for a few hours, the waves they went through. And she attributed to that in being in the kind of meditative mode. She wasn't interfering from it. She wasn't distracting herself from it or being distracted by daily life. She was just feeling it in a much more pure way. And in feeling it more purely, it just kind of went through its process much quickly. And so it passed through. Some people report that their emotional life becomes less intense through meditating, and some people more intense. What's interesting about meditation, this kind of practice, is it's best not to have a fixed idea of what's going to happen to you. Because for different people, it varies how it is for people. So it's clean. Great.
I have noticed there is a rhythm to the physical sensations that I go through when I meditate, because my hands are very cold, so I concentrate on that. And by the end, my foot goes numb. So that's always the case. Kind of become a rhythm.
Great. Good. Is there a question or?
Is good or bad is not like word, but
it's appropriate.
Fine.
Yeah, if those are your primary experiences, the most compelling experiences as you're meditating, then meditating on those is the appropriate thing to do. If the cold hands are stronger than your breath, and just be there with the cold hands until that changes. And if the numbness of your feet, the pain in your legs are the strongest, just be there for a while. Occasionally, if it's something that happens all the time, like some people have their feet fall asleep quite regularly and it goes numb, and it might feel somewhat intense. Occasionally, if something is regular like that, sometimes people will just after a while just ignore it. And because it's been there a long time, and they find it more useful to go back to the breath, even though it's somewhat intense. So I like to use the expression, we pay attention to whatever is most compelling. Most compelling is a little bit subjective. Because it's not just necessarily because something's intense, but it's also because we either were interested in it or we're not so interested in it or something else. So it's a little bit of subjective aspect of that also. So if you've been with, certain things like, numbness, for 2 months in your legs and you know, might experiment just not paying attention to it for a few times and see what it's like then.
One thing that's been very interesting for me has been the sense of time. I find virtually every time I've done this, I've been in some physical discomfort with my back, so I thought especially raising it to 30 minutes, it would be a little tough. And I'm pretty sure I'm awake and present the whole time, but I'm always blown away at how quickly it goes. It seems subjectively 10 to 15 minutes, like time after time. And I'm aware of the thoughts coming and going, but I haven't quite figured it out.
It can happen that way. Sometimes it can be very engrossing to be involved in meditation, and the time can go by very quickly. Sometimes, time itself is a concept. We think of time as being some absolute thing, but it's very much mediated through concepts concepts we have. And so when we start kind of softening our conceptual mind, seeing things through conceptually, then the sense of time can change and vary, And we know that because sometimes if it's really boring and some activity, it can seem like you're there for 2 hours and it's been 5 minutes. And sometimes something is so compelling, so interesting that 2 hours goes by and you thought it was 5 minutes. So same thing can happen in meditation.
I think really difficult to be customer in the last 2 years as well. And I'm finding it really difficult to be disciplined and to do it. And also, my family's been going through some crisis, not personally, but within the family.
Yeah.
So I'm really resisting doing meditation, and I can't sit still, So I'm sure I'm not the only one that happens to, but do you have any ideas on how to be more disciplined at doing it? I kind of
So the main issue is doing it or not doing it. And in the last couple of weeks, last week, you haven't done it much, and there's some resistance to doing it, and life is more complicated, so it's maybe hard to find the time and all that. Makes sense. One of the things, I think that as a person does it over time and finds value in it, then it becomes more natural to want to do something that is of value. And so it's, you know, it's kind of like balancing priorities then. So it's really clear, oh, this is valuable, this is great. This makes a big difference in the rest of my life. And especially at times of crisis, someone needs to be a little bit calm. And so I think this is when I kind of need to meditate twice as much as usual in order to be more useful in that kind, to be helpful in that kind of situation. So if you see the value of it, that can be quite helpful.
It seems like I do the opposite. When you're okay, calm, I tend to want to do it more. And so you're saying you see the value in it when you're in a crisis.
For example, this is one way to do it. Another way to do it is to, it's kind of similar to what I just said, but is to look at what your intention is or your priorities in your life. What is most important for you? And what's your deepest intention for your life? And if the meditation practice is connected to your deepest intention, if you can see that, make that connection, then it should be easier to want to make time for it. If it's not connected to your deepest intention or some deep intention for your life, then it's going to be a lot harder because other things will take precedent. And maybe you shouldn't even bother if it's not that important. You know, other things, you know, you can do other things. And the other thing you asked about discipline, it is valuable to begin understanding how your mind works. The tricks of the mind, the patterns of the mind, the tendencies of the mind, the way you're disposed to relate to certain things. And as you get it, so part of that involves being mindful in your daily life, not just in meditation. So becoming mindful of that, what you just described, how you tend to react to times of crisis, and become really aware of that. The more aware of you are of it, the more then you're going to be able to make some different choice. When you see something really clearly, you can start becoming free of it and choose differently if that's the wise thing to do. So practice mindfulness in daily life then becomes an important aspect of this. Now, don't just rely on the mindfulness and meditation time. And as a person learns a little bit about how the mind works and the tricks of the mind, dispositions of the mind, then you might start seeing that it's valuable to have an absolute commitment to doing the meditation regardless of what's happening in your life. But, you know, if your house is burning down, maybe don't do it. But because the mind can have a very strong tendency to want to live by its preferences. For many of us, you know, we're kind of preference creatures. You know, if I like it or I don't like it. If I like it, I'll do it. If I don't like it, I won't do it. And it's really, if you want to become free, it's very helpful to establish something, do something, like meditation practice, that's outside of the realm of your preferences. So that you have this commitment, you're going to do it every day, whether you like it or not. That's what you do. And you get to see very clearly the mind it likes, the mind it doesn't like. You get to see and include that as part of the meditation practice. Some people have a strong tendency to only meditate when things are going well in their life. And some people have a strong tendency to only meditate when things are going bad in their life, when they're feeling bad, because they want to make themselves feel better. But when they feel good, why bother? So the different people have different tendencies. But if you just sit regardless, and you sit every day no matter what, then what happens is that over time, all the aspects of who you are will come through and be processed through the field of meditation, of meditative awareness. But if you only sit when you want to sit, when you have a preference, you only see part of yourself. Only part of you will be included as part of that. So knowing that piece of understanding can be helpful in deciding, okay, I'm going to stick to it. I'm going to keep doing it and just do it. And I know that it's very valuable to do it that way. And you can try it that way for 3-4 months and then reassess, is this really being valuable for you? Or was Gil's idea here? You know, just, you know, maybe good for him, but not for me. Try it out. So are some of these things helpful? One of the tricks of the trade for people who think that they don't have enough time to meditate or feel like they can't today or feel like they're too restless or something is no matter what, get in the meditation posture. And at the minimum, get into the meditation. And once you get there, then probably it seems a lot easier. Well, I can sit for a minute or I can sit maybe for a couple of minutes or I think I can deal with this level of restlessness a little bit. And so suddenly you're there and then it's a lot easier to continue. But if you have this idea, I have to sit for 45 minutes, you know, and then it can seem too daunting sometimes. But, you know, just start by just getting yourself in the posture and then see what arises from there, if that's all you can do. Okay. So, welcome back to our fifth evening, our last evening for the intro class. And we will do a meditation. So if you want to stand and stretch again, you're welcome to do that. And so then, softly closing your eyes, and then tuning into your posture, and take some care at the beginning of a meditation session that you're sitting with a posture that expresses some alertness, that you don't just sit there in a casual way, but you sit in a way that brings some intention to your posture, like you're really here, present. And that for most people, that means to sit up a little bit straighter than you normally would. It doesn't have to be a lot, but to give a little bit more strength or uprightness to your spine. And then it can be helpful at the beginning of the sitting to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you do these breaths, to use them as reminders to connect to your body, to come here. So as you breathe in, feeling your body almost as if you're feeling it from the inside. Breathe as full as you need to in order to really feel yourself stretching and expanding. And then as you exhale, to relax and let go. Let go of tension in your body, tension in your mind. Let go of thinking best you can. Breathing in deeply. It can be a gentle breath, but still deep, full breath. And then as you exhale, hang in there with the exhalation to the very end of the exhale. And perhaps there could even be a natural little pause at the end of the out-breath. Very briefly, perhaps. And into that pause, the in-breath arises on its own. And then letting the breath return to normal. And it can be helpful, also at the beginning of a meditation session, to let your attention roam around your body, to the different muscle groups in your body, to see if there's any muscles that might be easy to soften or relax. Sometimes the muscles of the face, the forehead, the eyes, the jaws. Perhaps as you exhale, you can soften your shoulders a little bit. And then see if you can soften your belly. Let the stomach hang forward, hang out. So it's relaxed as you breathe in and relaxed as you breathe out. And then taking a few moments here to have a global awareness of your body, feeling a sense of presence in your body, or just feeling your body as broadly as you can, just being here. Feeling the vitality of your body, the energy, the vibration, the sense of beingness. And then within the body, as part of the body, becoming aware of your breathing. Becoming aware of how your body experiences the breathing. The movement of your stomach or of your chest. Sensations of the air going in and out through the nostrils, perhaps. As if you're inside your body, experiencing it in the way the body experiences breathing. As you exhale, letting go or softening any thinking that's creeping in, relaxing the thinking mind. You can very, very softly name the in-breath as in, the out-breath as out, as a way of helping you stay connected to the breath. There's nothing you need to think about when you sit and meditate. It's enough just to be aware. If you hear sounds, then be aware of listening. Note it as hearing. If there are body sensations, note it as a body sensation. Feel it. If there are emotions, then do mindfulness of emotions. Letting your mind be at ease. See if you can let yourself be at ease about whatever is going on, even if the lack of ease. In a sense, mindfulness is an accepting practice. What is it that needs to be accepted in awareness for you to feel more present about what's actually happening and more at ease? It's important to be attentive to what reactions you might be having to what's happening, and to include that as part of the mindfulness, the accepting mindfulness. You don't like what's happening, clearly be aware, oh, this is what not liking is like. If you're really happy about what's happening, then be mindful of that. If you're worried, be mindful of that. If you're content, there's nothing which needs to be left outside of mindfulness. And then I'm going to offer you an image. Maybe we'll do it as a kind of guided visualization that points to an aspect of this practice. Imagine that you're sitting in a small one-room house. Cabin or hut. And in the middle of this one room little house, there is an easy chair. And you're sitting in that easy chair, relaxed, at ease. You're facing the front door. The front door is open. And there are five windows around the room, or facing outside, and they're all open. And as you're sitting there in the easy chair, relaxed, at different times, different birds and animals and things, people appear at the door or at the window. There's no need for you to get up towards them or do anything. All you need to do is to see them there, walking by. You're never quite sure which door or window the next sight will happen. But whatever you see, it's happening outside. You don't need to get up from your easy chair. This analogy of a house, one-room house, is used in Buddhism for the human being. And the five windows and the door are the five sense doors and that organ of perception which allows us to know that we're thinking and what's going on in the mind. So when you sit to meditate, if it's at all possible, see if you can sit as if in an easy chair and simply noticing, seeing what occurs at the different sense doors. Go towards it or go away from it or approve of it or disapprove of it. Just let it be. Sometimes body sensations arise. Sometimes sounds arise and pass. Sometimes feelings and emotions arise. And sometimes thoughts arise. And you can, if you just be in the easy chair of mindfulness, aware that this has arisen, this has come into existence. And that your job is simply be aware of it, that it's there until it passes away. Being relaxed, at ease, accepting of what's here, whatever it might be. And then in the last minute of the sitting, knowing that the sitting is going to end in a minute, can you be as fully present and accepting of what's here as possible? So sometimes in meditation, the last thing you would associate your how you are is as if you're sitting in an easy chair, relaxed and accepting what's going on. And then in a kind of ironic or paradoxical way, the practice is to try to meet or be present for the agitation or the restlessness or the unease that you might be feeling. And the bottom line of the practice is simply noticing what's happening. The instructions to be accepting of what's here or to be open to it or to be at ease about what's going on, that can be helpful to work towards that or do it. But if it's not happening, then don't worry about it. The bottom line is simply noticing this is what's happening now and to let the noticing be, the, in a sense, the container within which the awareness is a container within which what needs to happen can happen. And we kind of get out of our own way by just holding things in awareness, whatever is going on. If any of the instructions so far seem a little bit too complicated for you, just coming back and being mindful of breathing and staying with the breath is just very significant in its own right. And in some sense, going through the instructions I've done so far, the breath the first week, the body second, the emotions the third, and thoughts last week, might have been too fast for some of you, and maybe for all of you. And that maybe it makes more sense for you is to spend 2 or 3 months on just kind of getting yourself settled and centered on the breath and getting familiar there. And then once you have that kind of a little bit more going, then spend another couple of months including then the body, the bodily sensations, the way we talked about the second week. And then later the emotions and then later the thoughts. You don't have to do it and just kind of, you know, jump ahead. But at some point in the practice, the idea is to include everything that occurs within the field of awareness. There's nothing which needs to be considered outside or needs to be excluded or denied or pushed away. And some of the art of the practice, some of the endeavors of the practice is to recognize how we're not accepting, how we're reacting or resisting or if that's what's going on. And then learning how to be wise about that and be kind about it, to be generous and a generous spirit about how we are. And not to beat ourselves up or be critical of ourselves. I think this kind of approach is very helpful for people, especially here in the West, where there's an epidemic degree of people who feel some sense of personal lack or inadequacy or lack of self-worth or somehow some self-criticism. And this practice, in a sense, is meant to kind of pull the rug from underneath that kind of unhealthy approach to relating to ourselves. On the other side, the other end of that might be being too arrogant or thinking too highly of yourself and, you know, too proud of yourself, whatever. And the practice pulls the rug from underneath that too. There's a beautiful teaching in by the Buddha where he defines conceit as being of three different kinds. And conceit here is understood to be kind of an unhealthy tendency of the mind and something that the practice is supposed to kind of pull the rug from underneath and show you that you don't need to live by any one of these three conceits. And one kind of conceit is the one most of us here in the West think of as conceit, and that is that we're better than someone else, or better than everybody else. You know, so we're better than. The second kind of conceit for the Buddha is thinking that we're worse than, we're less than someone else. And the third kind of conceit, and this is what really gets, especially Americans, I think, is that we're equal to everybody else. What's left? And what's left is don't bother comparing yourself to anybody. There's no need. And there's actually kind of a self-preoccupation that can be involved, sometimes neurotically, involved in comparisons, even trying to make yourself equal to others, achieving equality. But you don't need to do it either three. Especially in meditation practice. So the mindfulness practice is an adventure. It's a fascinating way to really begin discovering oneself and to go into oneself and become familiar with how our minds work. And someone once said, I think she said it about her own mind, my mind knows no shame. And I don't know how it is for you, but it's really amazing what our mind can do and the tricks it can play and the activities on there. And sometimes you wouldn't even want to be associated with the kind of some of the things that your mind does. But it's quite an adventure, and also there's tremendous beauty in our hearts and our minds, and the mindfulness practice tends to reveal that more and more, especially for people who are not familiar with it. So it's a great adventure. It can be very helpful for people's lives. And the instructions I've given you so far are the kind of basic instructions that we usually give for this practice. What I'd like to talk about now is how to deepen in the practice once you've kind of gotten the basics and practiced it for a while. And there are two general ways of deepening the practice. One is to extend the practice beyond your formal meditation time into your daily life. And the second way is to bring together or support the mindfulness practice with a greater degree of concentration. So I'll talk about these two ways. The division or the line between our minds, our hearts in meditation and our minds and hearts outside of meditation is a relatively arbitrary line. There's no need to make a sharp divide between who we are in meditation and who we are outside. And so the principles of mindfulness of paying attention to our body, our sensations, our feelings, our thoughts, our breath, it's just as applicable in daily life as it is in meditation. And in fact, it might even be more useful in daily life to know what you're feeling and what you're thinking and what you're reacting and what's going on here than if in meditation. When I first started learning meditation and doing it on a regular basis, I started having a sense of well-being through the meditation. And it was quite palpable for me, kind of the sense of well-being I had. I knew very little about meditation when I first started. And so I was really blessed. The less you know, the better. And I apologize for having taught you so much during this time. It make it much more difficult for you, I'm sure. But what I learned was that because I knew so little about meditation, I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't expect anything, actually. I hadn't been taught, you know, that you're supposed to get concentrated or supposed to be super mindful or you're supposed to have maybe quiet your thoughts a little bit or you're not supposed to be reactive or whatever. In a sense, the only thing I learned was to be present and accepting of what was happening in the present. And so that's what I try to practice. I didn't have any idea that something was bad to happen. It just was happening. I was supposed to be present for it. And in fact, my mind didn't slow down very much. I still thought, but I didn't think of it as a problem. But what did happen for me was there was a kind of a settling into myself, a relaxing into myself, and an accepting of this moment in a very simple way that provided me with a sense of integrity that I was not familiar with in my daily life. A sense of being whole, being complete, being kind of authentic, not being fragmented, not running after things, not chasing after things, not hiding from things, not defending myself, not trying to build myself up. I was just there being what I was. And that, without trying to prove myself or do anything. And that felt like, the word I used back then was kind of, almost 30 years ago, was a sense of integrity. And then I noticed that I didn't have that same integrity in my daily life. And that was not acceptable for me. And it became my quest, my interest, to try to then extend what was happening in meditation to me into daily life. Could I live with that kind of integrity and authenticity in my daily life as well as I could on the cushion? And so then for many years, my mindfulness practice, supported by meditation, was really an endeavor to try to find how to extend what was happening in meditation into my daily life. It wasn't necessarily to be calm all the time or to be centered all the time, but to have something that more nebulous or vague that I called integrity all the time. It was to still a quest of mine. I don't feel like I've attained it completely, but it's certainly something that I'm still trying to do and trying to find the areas of my life that it's still relevant to exploring. So one of the ways of deepening the practice is to bring it into daily life. And in principle, it's a very simple thing. It's once again, it's simply noticing what's happening in the present as it's happening. And as some of you have discovered in meditation, the same thing will be true in your daily life. As you start paying attention to what's happening in the present, you'll notice how difficult it is to be in the present and how much your mind doesn't want to be in the present. It's planning the day or thinking about the conversation you had yesterday or rehearsing the past or, you know, all kinds of things that it does, fantasizing. And so the same thing applies. You know, okay, let go of this chatter, let go of the thinking, come back to the present moment. What you're actually feeling now, be with the breath. Sometimes it's very helpful in daily life to be with your breath. If you come to a red light and you have to wait for, you know, 30 seconds for the light to turn green, you could fantasize, you could judge the other drivers, you could do all kinds of wonderful things. Or you could simply come back and just be with your breath for those 30 seconds. And the breath can calm you, center you, bring you to the present moment. Or you could, or you're standing in line at the supermarket. And maybe, you know, you might actually be useful to choose the long line. Because then you have more time to do this. And then you stand there and you do body meditation. Maybe you do breath meditation or use, or maybe just do kind of check into your body. And really kind of find out, where's your body now? What's going on? Are you in a hurry? Is your body tense and kind of racing ahead? Or is it relaxed? Is it tired? What's going on? And spend some quality time with yourself, really checking in, getting to know, you know, what's going on. And having that extra time because you chose the longer line gives you a chance to really kind of find out what's going on and let go of some of the momentum of your day that maybe not so useful to have. Or you get up to the cash register. And the cashier says something unkind to you. And you could, of course, just punch him out. Or, you know, scream for the manager or do something. Or you could just be present for that event for a moment. This is the mindfulness, I'm practicing mindfulness. What just happened? What's happening now? What am I feeling? What's happening to that person who just said it, now that I'm quiet and just paying attention to what's going on? And a different world will open up to you if you take even just, you know, 2 or 3 seconds, a gap in your day, to just practice noticing what's happening here, what's going on. And then, what do I want to do? What do I really want to do, given what just happened? And you might find out that maybe in your heart's heart, you don't want to punch the guy out. Or you don't want to say something nasty back. Maybe it's just too, you know, it's just not an interesting thing to do in your heart's heart. Maybe there's a wiser thing to do. Maybe doing nothing is wise sometimes. Maybe saying kindly, you know, oh, that, you know, that hurt me that you said that. Just a very calm, relaxed way. Well, that was actually painful to hear that. If you want to get to someone, that's a, you know, it's so much better. But don't do it for that intention, please. But it can make an impact, you know. People will stop pretty quickly. And you're telling, you're kind of practicing mindfulness out loud. You're saying, oh, I feel pain right now. So you'll find there's a lot of circumstances where it's very valuable to pay attention to what's going on. And I find myself in many situations where I kind of find out after the fact, you know, what's going on. You know, I might be engaged in some passionate way, in some kind of angry way or something, what's going on. And there might be a gap in the situation for a moment, and I tune into what's going on to my body, and I'm, you know, leaning across the counter, you know, trying to get my point across. And I wasn't so present then. So it's very helpful to sort of take time to find out what's going on now, what's happening, where's my mind now, where's my heart now, what's my feelings. And to do that, to make a habit of that through the day. And I have a very strong habit of checking into my body a lot. And I find that it's a real safeguard, it's a real protection of my not running amok or being excessively reactive, of coming back and being centered or balanced in some way. So one way to develop this practice then is to take interest in doing it in daily life. And some of the homework assignments that you're given in some of the handouts, have little assignments to do that in daily life, you know. Do it, you know, choose an hour or 5 minutes, do it washing dishes or do it in different situations. Some people find that trying to be mindful the whole day is too big of a task. And so they'll choose particular things to do for a week. Like, I'm going to try to be mindful while I wash dishes. I'll try to be mindful while I shop or while I clean or while I do X, Y, or Z. Okay, this is what I'm going to do this week. The next week you change, you do something else. I'm going to be mindful while I eat. For this week, I'm going to eat breakfast in silence or eat one meal a day in silence so I can really practice mindfulness while I eat rather than the usual way of reading the newspaper and talking and listening to the radio and balancing my checkbook all at the same time, whatever, you know. You know, and stuffing my food in my mouth. It's fascinating the world that opens up if you eat in silence and eat a little bit slower than usual and pay attention to your subjective experience while you're eating. You might learn a lot about yourself just by doing that a few times. Something else people like to do is to have little mindfulness cues through the day. And so something to remind you, you know, or to pay attention, like you get Allison's little CD, and then you just put it in your tape machine, and periodically you hear this bell. And you go about your daily life, but then you hear this bell. What was that bell? The bell, the mindfulness bell. What's happening? Oh, I've been lost in fantasy for the last 10 minutes. You know, I've been doing, you know, I haven't been present at all because I'm so upset with, you know, what just happened. Whatever, you know. Oh, and it's useful. Oh, I'm upset. That's what's happening. If you really admit what's happening, it changes the ecology of the inner life. How long does it take before you can really admit it? Really admit it. I mean, not just casually. So a mindfulness bell, something like that, can, oh, what's happening now? I use door frames for a long time. Kind of odd thing, though. It's because in Zen monasteries they actually use that as a mindfulness little thing, door frames. So I extended that elsewhere in my life. Is whenever I went through a door, I would use that as kind of a mindfulness bell. Okay, what's happening? I'm moving into a new environment. What's happening with me? What's happening in the present moment? And I found it very valuable to use door frames as a time to wake up. And I was surprised that often I wasn't awake when I was walking through the door, but the door would remind me. Some people use the telephone. Now, one option you have with telephones is to feel like answering the phone as quickly as you can is like really important. Like somehow it's a personal offense to the person who's calling if you don't rush over there and grab it before the second ring, or, you know, it's like, you know, you lose the person. Or you could let it ring for 4 or 5 times. Most people don't hang up that quickly. Most people are patient enough for 4 or 5 rings. And then you let the telephone ring a few times. And then just check in with yourself. Find out what's going on with you. Breathe once or twice. How are you really feeling? What's going on with you? And then answer the phone, having checked in. It makes a world of difference. I know I've heard of people who have gotten little stickers, like little dots or something, and put it on different things around their house, their place of work, like on the telephone or doorknobs or light switches or whatever. And every time they see this little dot, it's from, oh, you know, what's going on? What's happening now? And I find that helpful. Some people find it kind of strange, but, you know, some people find it very helpful to do that, because I think we need as much help as we can get. It's not so easy to practice being in the present. After a while, you know, it becomes interesting, you know, it becomes kind of like a habit, or becomes something, a strength that we carry with us. And we more and more tend to want to be mindful rather than not. Another really fascinating place to practice mindfulness is to practice mindfulness of speech. To be mindful while you speak. And if you look a little bit at how other people speak, like watch for a week, try to study, do people watching, watch other people speak, how they speak to you or to other people. And probably a percentage of the people you watch speak, you look at them and say, like, they're addicted. Like, they're like in a different zone. Like, what they're saying is so important, they're hardly even paying attention to you. Like, they're kind of like, pfft. And see if that ever happens. And it's very fun. It doesn't happen to any of you, right? So, but a lot goes on with our speech. There's a lot of emotions, a lot of beliefs, a lot of intentions, a lot of things we're trying to do. There's a whole world that goes on when we speak that's invisible to us if we just speak on automatic pilot. But if we start paying attention a little bit, or pausing even for a moment before you speak, to notice, you know, why do I want to say this? Oh, because this person really needs to know this piece of information. Is that true? How much of what you have to say is essential information to the other person? And how much of it are you trying to convey something else besides information? And what are you trying to convey? And to really be honest about that is really fascinating. So it's a whole other area of exploring mindfulness. So there's a lot of ways to do it. And my encouragement to those of you who are interested in this is to do it in a playful way, in an enjoyable way. Have a good time. Have fun with it. Experiment with different ways and see if you can begin through experimentation and playfulness and being in the present moment to begin finding the value of it. And in finding the value of it, wanting to do it more kind of just because it's, you know, it's great. The other way of deepening the practice is to combine it with concentration, to support it with more concentration. And there's a number of ways of developing more concentration for the mindfulness practice. One way is simply to do a concentration meditation. And so for just staying on the breath, and just being focused on the breath and not wavering, like letting the mind waver from the breath, is a concentration practice. If you just do that for a while, it tends to develop concentration over time. Another way is to just practice mindfulness on a regular basis. Practicing mindfulness every day, in terms of meditation practice, having meditation every day, the continuity of the practice tends to create a support or encourage concentration over time. The mind gets calmer, more centered, and stronger. And over time, the mind tends to get more concentrated more easily. So that having continuity is very, very helpful, practicing every day. There's a kind of a little secret about meditation, is that some of the benefits come when we build up momentum. And if you, you know, the Buddha's analogy is that if you want to make fire by rubbing sticks together, there's probably, you know, modern examples. We don't do that so much anymore, right? But maybe what we do is we're going to heat the tea water on the stove, right? And we turn on the stove, and then 10 seconds later, say, wait a minute, you know, we turn it off when we go outside and do something. We come back, you know, 5 minutes later and turn it on again, and then we turn off the stove, and then, you know, the water never gets hot. And you have to keep the fire on long enough to get the water to boil. So so same with meditation. If you sit, you know, today, and you don't sit again for 10 days, each time it's valuable. I'm not going to say it's, you shouldn't do it. But what you're missing out on then is the momentum that happens if you do it every day. You're not getting the fire strong enough then to let it boil to a new level. So that's one thing that's very helpful if you're interested in deepening the practice, is really do it every day. Though I must admit, when I was my first 2 years of practicing every day, I practiced actually twice a day, my first 2 years of practicing regularly. But I was introduced to meditation at the San Francisco Zen Center. And for whatever reason, I never understood, they never meditate there on Sundays. It's a Sabbath, I guess. I don't know. And so I just thought that was a good thing. So I would meditate twice a day, 6 days a week. And maybe there's some wisdom to that. I don't know. You know, not to be too fanatic. And anyway, it worked great for me. But basically, the principle is continuity, to develop that continuity. The other way is to do meditate more. And you can meditate longer, build up to sitting longer. Sometimes if you sit for 20 minutes, after some months, maybe you want to sit 25 or 30 or 35 or 40 or 45. Or sometimes it's really nice to sit for an hour. As someone who's a novice to this, it can seem, you know, impossible to sit that long. But if you keep sitting and kind of a little bit start slowly, gently pushing the edge, you might find that you can sit longer and longer. And if it's enjoyable and valuable enough, then maybe it's worth making the time in your life to do that. And sitting longer sometimes can help deepening the concentration. Also, going on meditation retreats can be very helpful. And that's one way of developing greater concentration with the mindfulness. Because meditation retreats, in our tradition, are generally silent retreats where basically all we do all day is meditate. We don't just do sitting meditation, we also do walking meditation, which is described in our current newsletter. And but the day is silently spent engaged, trying to be present all the time. And there's very little, supposedly no distractions during the retreat that would prevent you from being in the present moment. And so the continuity of practicing present moment practice over and over again, without the distractions of work or conversations or having to cook for yourself or to do all these different things, over the course of the retreat, tends to build more concentration, more stillness, and greater sensitivity and mindfulness. And it's really wonderful. And generally, it's good to build up slowly there also. Here at IMC, we have half-day retreats that are basically 2.5 hours long or so. And then we have day-long retreats that go from 9 to 4:30. We have longer retreats, and there's residential retreats that are 2 days long or 3 days or 4 days long. We actually go and live at a meditation center. And then there's 10-day retreats, and some people sit longer for several months at a time. And so one way of developing more concentration is to go on these retreats. Why develop more concentration? Why is that useful? A concentrated mind is a mind that's still, that can see more clearly. It's kind of like if you have a telescope and you want to see something in the distance. And you can kind of see it. You can kind of, it helps you to see, you know, have this telescope. You can kind of see it, you know. It's there, yeah. But if you put it on a tripod, then the telescope is going to be much more stable. And you know, your wobbling is not going to wobble the telescope. And so you can see, because of the stability and steadiness of the telescope, you can see much more clearly what's there. So the same thing is true internally with the mind. If the mind is more still and more stable, which is what concentration brings, then the mind is not going to waver or wobble as much. And so you can see much more clearly what you're looking at. You might see what's there, but you know, your kind of mind's kind of bouncing around and going away and coming back. But if you have this concentration, you can really kind of keep it focused and see it, and really see deeply what's going on. And part of what the long-term goal of the mindfulness meditation in the Buddhist tradition is to begin having the ability to see below the surface appearance of our experience. And the surface appearance, to a great extent, is very much mixed up with the concepts or interpretations of what we're seeing, what's there. And it can be quite innocent. So, for example, one of the first times I noticed this was when I was at Tassajara Monastery. And they have a beautiful hot bath there, natural hot springs. They made these baths and stuff. And it was, you know, they had these baths you can go soak in. And one day I came to the baths, And the bath was not a bath. It was a yogurt incubator. And they had these big gallon jugs, 5-6 of them, in this kind of great big long frame thing. And they'd lowered it into the hot tub because it was just the right temperature for making yogurt. And now it was no longer a hot bath. I couldn't get in. It was a yogurt incubator. You know, there are a lot of things that we call something because it has a certain function, but it could have a different function. We call it something else. Like, I'm kind of fond of this thing here. This is called a podium. A piece of wood that was made into a podium. But if you'd seen where this wood came from, you would have thought that this was flooring. Because this is pergo flooring made into a podium. Is it a floor? No, it's a top of a podium. So it's a little bit arbitrary what we call things. We tend to think sometimes that our concepts are really what things really are. But really, it's our interpretation of what things are. This room here is now a meditation hall. It used to be a hall of worship of a church. We've had events here where we turned it into a theater. We used a stage up there. We could also turn it into a dance hall. The meditation hall at the San Francisco Zen Center used to be, the meditation hall used to be a dance hall. Our concepts are quite flexible. And so often when we see reality, we often see it through the filter of our concepts. And part of the function of deep mindfulness is to begin to see beyond that conceptual level. So why bother? Why is that important? So I'll give a little demonstration. So I'll hold up this flower. Now, you can all see the flower. Can you see the flower? You're probably wondering, what's going on? And you see the flower in and of itself. In Buddhism, we talk about the suchness of the flower. Just the suchness of the flower by itself. You see the flower, just the flower by itself. It's beautiful. Looking at the flower. But I can do something very interesting. I can lift up this flower and put it next to it. And now we can say something we couldn't say before. Now we can say that this is the small flower and this is the big flower. So what? Now watch a magic. It's magic in front of your eyes. No sleight of hand. Just watch this, okay? This is the small flower, right? See? You convinced? Really? Are you sure? This is a small flower, right? What is it now? Smallness and bigness is not inherent in the flower. It's a concept that we apply to it depending on what we compare it to. But the suchness of the flower is independent of what we compare it to. The suchness of the flower is independent of other flowers. So that's nice about flowers, right? What does this have to do with us? When I was 13, it was 1967, which was a time of, to those of you who might remember, of interesting times. And I went that summer of 67 to live in Italy. I'd been living in California. So I missed the summer of 67 here. And however, when I came to this little provincial town in Italy, I was—I had the longest hair of anybody there because, you know, we were a little bit ahead of the curve, and I had the only one who had blue jeans. You know what that meant? It meant that I was the coolest kid in town, and I knew it. I don't know if anybody else knew it, but at least I knew it. And there was a certain kind of vitality that I got being a 13-year-old kind of hip kind of kid. You know, in this provincial town, a little town in Italy. So I got energy, I got vitality, I felt kind of good about myself. And then, at the end of the summer, I flew across the Atlantic back to Los Angeles, to California. And a lot had happened in the summer of 67. And people's hair, the guy's hair was a lot longer than mine had grown. I don't know how they managed, but they had a lot longer hair. And they had, I had blue jeans, they had blue jeans, but they had figured out all these interesting things to do to their blue jeans in the course of the summer. They had, people had bleached them. they had put them through washing machines 10,000 times, or some people who had put them out in the road so the cars would drive over them. They cut them up and then sewed them back together again. I just had blue jeans. And I had this, you know, short hair now. And I was deflated. I didn't feel so good about myself. And all that happened was I crossed the Atlantic, and now I could compare myself to different people. Our sense of self can be a tremendous source of suffering. And the problematic sense of self usually arises out of some kind of comparison. I'm too tall, I'm too short, I'm too big, I'm too narrow, my nose is too big, I have too much hair, I have too little hair, my butt is this way, my butt is not that way, my thighs are this, that. It's all comparative thinking. And it involves seeing ourselves through the filter of concepts and ideas and comparisons, conceit. It's not seeing ourselves through the suchness of who we are. The suchness of who we are has no problem with our hairline or our color or size of our stomach or whatever it might be. So as we begin paying it more careful attention in mindfulness and mind becomes stiller and more focused, we begin seeing that we don't have to experience ourselves or experience our life through the filter of these concepts. We see deeper than the concepts, we go beyond them into the suchness, the thusness of how things actually are in and of themselves, how we are, how the situation is. And it tends to free up a lot of the problematic ways in which we relate to life when we're relating to it through comparative thinking of better and worse and good and bad and all the different ways we live. And we start seeing things more clearly as they actually are in and of themselves. And it turns out that things in and of themselves as they actually are is actually quite different in some of the ways we tend to see them. And it tends to be liberating to see things more as they actually are than it is to see them through the filter of our concepts. So one of the reasons why in Buddhism we want to develop this greater concentration with the mindfulness is to become still enough and quiet enough to be able to get beyond that conceptual level of our experience. And that is a great adventure to do that. It's not necessarily easy to do that, but as the practice deepens and we kind of learn the terrain, we go deeper and deeper. The last thing I want to say before maybe we take some questions is there are a lot of ideals in Buddhism, or a lot of ideals in meditation. The ideal of being mindful, for one. The ideal of being concentrated. The ideal of maybe being accepting of what's happening. One of the best approaches to an ideal, spiritual ideal, one of the healthiest ways, is not to go for it directly, but rather to notice what gets in the way, what prevents you from getting there. So rather than noticing, you know, trying to hold yourself being mindful, notice what keeps you from being mindful. Now, it's a little bit trick because to notice that, you have to be mindful. You have to be in the present moment to notice what's keeping you from being present. But at least then you're paying attention to what's taking you away, and it's less likely to take you away then. If you want to get concentrated, become aware of how your mind is not concentrated. What's going on there? Really get to become an expert. Really study it. Why am I? What's going on? What's this distraction like? What's it feel like? And what's going on here? Because if you try to go after an ideal directly, sometimes it's frustrating, and you're more prone to judge yourself that way. Oh, I'm not doing it. I'm not living up to it. So the beauty about the mindfulness practice is mindfulness can be done with anything that's happening in the present moment. So we just notice what's happening now, what's happening now. And if what you have to notice is how it's difficult for you to be present, then be present for that difficulty. And some people will override that. They'll sit there trying to be with their breath, It's really difficult to be with the breath because they're just really furious with their spouse. But being furious with your spouse is not a particular spiritual thing to do, right? So this is my spiritual time, so I'm not going to pay attention to that. And that sets up this tension then. And what you need to do is forget about the breath and notice that, oh, being furious with, you know, this person is really what's making it difficult to be present. And then miraculously you're present for that. It's a present moment thing. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Got that? Okay. So do you have any questions about this, what I've said so far? No questions? Yes?
Sometimes I meditate, thinking about just mortality, just big things, right?
Thinking about your mortality?
Yeah.
Well, there's different ways of answering that question. There is a meditation practice in Buddhism which is not mindfulness practice, as I've taught you, but is a contemplation of death and dying, which is actually a contemplate, you know, that death is uncertain, we don't know when it's going to come, to kind of reflect about death and dying. But if it makes a person sad or filled with grief or kind of spiral down thinking about that, that's not useful. But if it helps you be more inspired to practice or take your life more seriously or appreciate your life in a deeper way, then it can be useful to do that. When you're doing the mindfulness meditation, as I've taught you here, that's not really thinking about anything in particular. So those kind of thoughts might bubble up. But then the idea is just to notice, just be mindful of that without engaging it any further. Oh, thinking about my mortality is happening. And just seeing it clearly for what it is, practice mindfulness of thinking. And don't you don't need to be involved in it or get engaged in it. And after a while, probably it will fade away by itself.
It's usually a
liberty problem. It can be. And that's usually why it is a Buddhist meditation practice to do it. So if that's the case, you might want to spend some time actually doing that. But to make that a different time than your meditation time. Because if there's a lot of different kinds of meditations to be done, but if you start confusing them, and you know, then the mind doesn't have develops kind of bad habits. So maybe be very clear, now I'm doing, you know, reflection on death. And now I'm doing the kind of more non-discursive mindfulness practice. Yes?
I'm just trying to kind of take in what you're saying. And sometimes like I'm thinking, could I ever be mindful of being, that I'm being mindful? And then I'm thinking, well, one of the activities I do a lot of is reading. And if I were trying to be mindful when I was reading, could I continue reading? And it's almost like having this observing self. So much of my life, I'm just in it. You know, there's just nothing. For example, when I'm reading something.
Sure.
And the thought of beginning to observe that part that is usually not observed seems. Sometimes I can imagine it like when I'm waking up, like walking through a doorway. And I'm checking in with what's going on. But the thought of sustaining that becomes kind of a weird idea.
Uh-huh.
Like even while I'm reading, just the thought of, mm-hmm. Like, do you ever mindfully read? What
sure.
Does that mean?
Sure. You know, you don't have to be, it's not necessary to be mindful all the time. I mean, there's a tremendous beauty in life, joy in life, to be absorbed in some activity and just kind of lose yourself in it. And that's a beautiful thing at times. You sometimes get in trouble by losing yourself in your activity, but there are times when it's quite innocent and quite beautiful to do. Like reading a book, sometimes it's great to do it that way. It is possible to be mindful while you read. But if a person's not familiar or hasn't developed some skill in being mindful, it can feel very cumbersome at first or very awkward or impossible. It's like, what would it be like? I mean, it's probably some good example of things that there's some kind of overarching awareness of the event that you can have once you've mastered it. Like if you're riding a bicycle, learning to ride a bicycle, you know, at first, you know, you're kind of mindful of certain aspects of the riding bicycle. And then once you kind of, someone asks you, be aware of the whole environment while you're riding your bike. You know, you just kind of fall all the time. But once you've kind of gotten the hang of riding the bike, then you can open your awareness in a bigger way. I don't know if that was a good example, but it can be done. I do it at times. And sometimes I lose myself in a book, and sometimes I stay very mindful as I'm reading. It helps if some people will confuse mindfulness with thinking about what's going on in the present. And mindfulness is not that. So if they're trying to think while they're trying to read, sometimes it makes it harder. So I want to say a few more things before we end tonight. One of the ways of supporting a meditation practice is to occasionally go and sit with other people. Sometimes it's very helpful to meditate with others because, for a number of reasons, we learn from others, we feel support from others, inspiration from others. Sometimes it can be a little difficult to sustain a meditation practice if we don't know anybody else who does it. And everybody, all our friends and family are kind of, you know, joking or teasing us or worse about what we're doing. Sometimes the results of meditation practice is that some of our values begin to change a little bit. And so we kind of live in, or kind of some of our more unhealthy patterns maybe are not, we don't want to live that way anymore. And sometimes knowing that other people are changing their values, living by better values, is really helpful. And so being around other people who meditate a little bit, it can be helpful just to know other people are kind of interested in the same thing. And there's a lot of places you can go to sit with people. You can sit here with us if you'd like. You're welcome to come here. Most communities have little sitting groups of some kind or other. There's Mountain View, there's a little Zen center. And some communities have Quaker meetings. You can go Sunday morning, sit with the Quakers. They don't mind if you sit quietly with them. It's very supportive. But periodically, to sit with other people, I think is very helpful. You're welcome to come here. The way that IMC is kind of operates is kind of on an informal basis. So I hope that you feel welcome to come anytime you want and leave anytime you want. Come and go. You know. There's no membership. There's no requirements to, you know, just how you should be here. Just if it's useful for you, please come. And we have a lot of different activities here. You can look at our newsletter. Thursday evening is a little bit more for beginners. The people who give the talks on Thursday evenings tend to give talks that are more basic to support people new in the practice. And in fact, along that line, the woman who's going to give the talk tomorrow, I asked her to give the talk that would be the follow-up talk that I normally give after this five-week course, kind of like the sixth week of the five-week course, and on a topic called the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are kind of very clearly the things that often very difficult, make being present very difficult. So it's kind of like addressing and really seeing those and learning how to be mindful of these five things. And if you want to do that, you can come tomorrow night and check out Thursday and forget and, you know, get the continuity, the sixth week of the five-week course. So there's all kinds of things here, and you're welcome to come in any way you want. And so different people will find different value from this kind of practice. And some people will find that it's helpful for them just kind of stress reduction and help calm their life and bring a little bit of sanity to their life. Some people will find that it helps address some of these big issues. Some people, because of facing big issues like mortality, you know, come and find a lot of help from just being present and learning to be present for what's going on and learning to address these things that happen around those kinds of issues. Some people have big existential questions, that they're big spiritual questions that they want to address through the practice. Some people will take this meditation practice quite far. The practice is very simple in its essence. It's simply noticing what's happening in the present moment. But to do that in a very careful way, a consistent way, the Buddhist will say, can take you all the way to what the Buddhists call liberation or freedom. And you know, the practice is available to you to whatever degree that you're interested in it. And I hope that all of you find some value in it in some way. I think that's all I have to say. Anything else I usually say that I haven't said? Donna. The way that our center operates is on what we call a dana basis. It's a Pali word, sometimes translated as donation. Because it has a different feeling, I think, than sometimes donation. Dana is meant to be a freely given act of generosity. And so in that is the idea that nothing's expected. And so the goal, the ideal at least in our tradition, is that the people who offer the teachings or the center that offers a practice place, it really tries to offer it in that spirit of freely given generosity, where nothing's really expected in return. However, we wouldn't be able to survive here, you know, unless we had we were in support. So then there's a kind of usually somewhat casual approach of just having a basket or a bowl, or we have a box here by the door, where anybody who would like to offer dana, freely given generosity, because they want to support what goes on here, see it continue and thrive and be available to other people to come here and practice, then people can practice this practice of dana, freely given generosity on their own. And so all the expenses of running this place, the whole place, this whole our owning this building is all an expression of people practicing that practice. So it makes me quite happy. I look around and see what's here and all the work that's done here and all the volunteers, and it all comes out of the spirit. And no one's been asked to pay anything and no one's been charged for anything, and I find it quite remarkable we have a thing like this. And it means that those people who have very little money or no money could come and not feel strange about that, because nothing's expected. And those people who have a lot of money, you know, phenomenally wealthy, you know, they can pay for the renovation of this room and replace that glass window. or whatever. This is what I... Yes? Oh, I'll teach it again, but in the spring, in May, I'm not going to... one of our seniors, kind of... one of our most senior students here is going to teach it in my stead. And I'll teach it again in the fall, maybe starting in September or October, I think. So usually I do it 3 times a year, but this year time I decided to do it 2x a year so that I could free up my time a little bit so I can teach something else. So in May or something, I'm going to do a different kind of 5-week series on a different topic, not the intro class. And then Andre will do that. And Andre is great. And it's also nice. I've been doing it for so long. I still love doing it. But I've been doing it so long, I thought some of you keep coming back. I don't understand. Like, it must be failing or something. You come back again and, you know, it's pretty straightforward. You get it, you go home and do it. But you come back and, well, I guess, you know, I'll try again. But it's very nice to get it from a different person. And so you might, you know, it's nice to hear how Andrea is going to do it. Yes?
What do you mean? Teaching?
Well, I know the title, but I don't know quite how I'm going to do it yet. But I want to teach a kind of intro class, but it'd be more explicitly a Buddhist class. Introduction to the basic principles and practices of a Buddhist life. Someone who's interested in kind of living a Buddhist life, what kind of elements would make up that kind of life. Mindfulness would be one piece of it, but be other pieces also. So I express my thanks to all of you for coming and being such good attendees, and my gratitude, because it's something I love a lot, the mindfulness practice, and to be able to share it with you and have your attention has been a privilege, and I hope I see you all again. Thank you.